On behalf of the Sunstone Foundation, we'd like to welcome all of you to the dinner this evening and thank you very much for your attendance this evening. I have been asked to offer an invocation on the food this evening, and after that we would invite you to enjoy your dinner, and then at the conclusion of dinner we'll have the other introductions and the program for this evening. Our Father in Heaven, we're very grateful for the opportunity of being gathered here the last 2 days in the capacity of the Sunstone Symposium. We're grateful for those who have prepared well and who have stretched us and helped us to grow and understand in many different areas and capacities. We're grateful this evening to be met in the capacity of dinner, to enjoy one another's company. We ask a blessing on the food, that it might be nourishing to our bodies. We pray that we might enjoy this evening, enjoy the program, and we're very grateful for Sunstone and the programs and dinners that it has offered to us during the past 2 days. We say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Hello. Good evening. Welcome to our program. The last event of the 1982 Sunstone Theological Symposium. In our flyer that we wrote, I promised that it would be a veritable feast. I had to argue with the art director; he hated that. That was real trite. But I think, at least for me, it has been a real feast. It's an extraordinary experience. It's hard to explain. People constantly come into our office, which I invite all of you to do, over in the old Bennett building, and they look around and they say, well, where's Sunstone? We say, it's right here. They say, they look in the offices, they see all the people and they say, well, I mean, who's the real power behind this organization? I mean, you know, we see all of you people, but I mean, who really runs Sunstone? And we say, well, we do. They say, no, I mean, who really supports Sunstone? And so I thought finally at last I would reveal the secret of who really, really supports Sunstone. And I thought I would ask all of the staff members of Sunstone to stand up so you could see their faces. They're just extraordinary. Stay standing for a second. Stay standing. Come on, you guys. Stand up. Okay, I want you to look at those faces. Look carefully. I think you'll see, if you really look very carefully, you can see an incredible creeping altruism in their faces. These are people who work for basically nothing. They work long, incredible hours. You call our office. And they say, well, how long are you open? And we say, oh, well, some of us will be here till midnight. And they say, well, is this extraordinary? I say, no, this is 6 nights a week. And this is the power behind Sunstone. They're terrific. Second of all, the power behind Sunstone is all of you. You know, look around the table. You may have seen that some of you have also caught the creeping altruism. There are people in this room who will remain nameless, but who have given incredible gifts to Sunstone. They have given time, money. People who come to the office, they say, can I help you? Can I proofread? Can I stuff envelopes? They've written articles. People come a long way to give us gifts. They send over presents, Dr. Pepper, in cases. They give us rides, places. They give us books. And it seems to me the strength of Sunstone is in your collective spirits. And it's something that is, you know, it's not visible in the office, but it's there nonetheless, and I think all of you here tonight probably feel it in the sessions, the sense of strength and unity. Sometimes the church, I hear people say, I love each and every one of you. And I think, you do not. I think, you don't even know me. You know? How could you possibly have that, you know? But I think there is a sense in which it's true to say, I love each and every one of you, because it's the sense that we're all here together, and the combination of your spirits is a sense of love, and there's no getting around it. This is the fourth year we've done this. We probably will try it again next year, but again, I need to ask for help. We didn't have a grant from Utah Endowment for the Humanities this year. And so I didn't know that we would even be able to do it again until January, which is why the programs were late, et cetera, et cetera. This year, I think I'm going to just cross my fingers and say, we will have a symposium start in September. Maybe the symposium programs will be off by August 15th this next year. And anyway, we ask for all of your help. Anything that you have to offer, we accept with gratitude. We are going to have another fundraising event in a month from now, which is an evening with Haim Potok. It will be up at the University of Utah in Kingsbury Hall, and it's on September 29th. We would ask all of you to support us again in that. Our speaker tonight, I'm especially pleased and delighted to introduce. He has just accepted a position as associate pastor in First Presbyterian Church in Burlingame, California, and just finished his Master of Divinity degree at Princeton Theological Seminary. From 1975 to 1978, he was vice president of Young Life, which is a non-denominational Christian organization. It's sort of like young adults, I think. An in-joke. And also has served formally as Special Assistant to the President and Deputy Director of Communication and Executive Director of the Inaugural Activities under President Nixon. Also got a BA degree from William College and an MBA from the University of Chicago. I think it's a special treat tonight. One of the managing editor was telling me, where can you find a person who's had this varied of an experience, from politic experience to prison experience to ministerial experience? And I personally am looking forward to his insight.
Thank you, Peggy. I could say you could find it with Chuck Colson. I can't refrain from my first little story because it's an old one, and I'm sure you've all heard it, particularly here. But 2-3 years ago, I'm sure you remember the good news, bad news jokes were in. And one of my favorite good news, bad news jokes was the story about the Pope and Billy Graham. And one day the Pope got on the hotline and called Billy and said, "Billy, I've got good news and bad news." And Billy said, "Well, tell me the good news first, Pope." And the Pope said, "I had a direct revelation from God, and I can tell you, Billy, that the second coming is about to occur." And Billy said, "Pope, if that's the good news, there certainly can't be any bad news." The Pope said, "I'm afraid there is, Billy. He's coming to Salt Lake City." As a person who has spoken before varied audiences in the last number of years, particularly since Watergate, I've often felt, I think, like the Christian who used to have to meet the lion back in the days of early Christianity. And it's always particularly reminiscent to me when I speak before an audience that I'm not really familiar with. But as you remember, in those days, many Christians ended up in the Colosseum with the lion. And this particular day, the Christian decided when he got out in the middle of the Colosseum that his best approach to salvation might be for him to get down on his knees and begin to pray. And lo and behold, he looks up and he sees the line facing him also in a position of prayer. So the Christian says to the lion, well, now that we can begin to communicate, the lion says, communicate hell, I'm saying grace. And I'm afraid I sometimes feel, and may tonight feel like that Christian. Before I start my more or less formal remarks, I would like to make the disclaimer. I am a Presbyterian. I've been a Presbyterian all my life. I graduated from Princeton Seminary and will begin an associate pastor in a Presbyterian church. Consequently, I hope all of you who are not Presbyterians here, and I know there are a few of you, will take the context of my remarks on the basis that this is my theology that I have learned in my process, and hopefully we all can learn hopefully something from it, but it may not fit necessarily into your theology. One of the great issues to me in society today, and one of the issues that we all deal with, is I think really, do societies learn from their mistakes? Certainly you would think with all of the intelligence and all of the rational thought process that the human can engage in, that society would continually improve itself and would eventually lead to the kind of society that would be the perfect society. Recently, though, I think events would indicate that, on the whole, societies learn very little from past mistakes. One of the great interesting news articles recently was the plight of the three major networks over their budget this year. The networks have large news organizations, as you know, CBS and NBC and ABC, and they, like all other corporations, have to submit budgets and have to stay within their budgetary limits. And their budgets had been just absolutely decimated because of a terrible occurrence this year, in that there were three wars going on. And so first they were all down in El Salvador for the first few months of the year, and evidently that was what they had in their budget, was one war. And then they ended up in the Falkland Islands, and the Falkland Islands really ruined them because they had to be in London and Buenos Aires at the same time. And then to top it off, Beirut comes along and just makes their whole budgetary scheme fall apart. And so there was this long article, I think, in the New York Times bemoaning the fate of the network profit structure this year because of these unfortunate wars that were occurring in too rapid succession. I'm somewhat in jest about the network's problem. I hopefully am more serious, though, about what has happened just this year. We could discuss El Salvador in some length, and I'm not going to try tonight. It's a very confusing situation. I think also the situation in Beirut and in the Mideast, Israel and the Arab countries is also very complicated, and I could spend, and we could all spend days and still not understand necessarily what is really going on there. I think the Falkland Islands, though, is more interesting in the ethical, theological sense, because basically the Falkland Islands was a war with absolutely no purpose. Here is a little island of 1,800 people and a lot of sheep. And I think sheep are very important. When we consider that there was literally a major war fought over an island with that number of people, where one of the great powers in the world, Great Britain, and a lesser power, Argentina, decided that that island and that situation was important enough to literally spend billions of dollars in defense dollars to kill hundreds of people, and I don't really know what the total count is of the number of dead from both sides, to disrupt the psychological context of a nation, particularly probably now for Argentina more than for Great Britain, since Great Britain won and Argentina lost, to involve themselves in such a petty venture when we, in any rational sense, could say that there was absolutely no purpose for that war. And as far as I can tell, there was no purpose for that war. No real purpose. Now, if you would even buy into some of that, that the Falkland Island situation was a relatively insignificant activity that cost many lives and billions of dollars, why? Why, if we are rational people and if we understand that we only do things that are correct and appropriate and necessary, why would we engage in such an activity? Now, that's a very nice, clear-cut one, and I was glad the Falkland Islands came along because it makes this talk much better. I didn't have as good examples before. But I could go into many other areas aside from wars. The world is rife with famine. The world is rife with poor medical care. None of us have to go to Calcutta to understand how many people die every night on the streets in Calcutta. Mother Teresa has certainly been a shining example of showing us what occurs in cities around the world of that type. The United States is maybe better off. We don't let them die in the streets quite to the extent they die in Calcutta. We probably feed the people here a little better than they are fed in India. That's also correct. But I think if you went to most of our major cities and went into most of our major ghettos, you would see famine and you would see hopelessness and despair. And almost all of it basically is needless. There is no question that this world, not just this country, can feed everyone in this society, can take care of all of the normal medical needs. I'm not talking about heart bypasses. I'm talking about just basic medical needs. And that basically everyone would have some opportunity for employment if society was structured under the kind of guidelines that rational man might consider. But this does not happen. President Johnson in 1964 basically initiated a war on poverty in this country, and I don't think there's any question, both liberal and conservative critics would say the program failed. It did not fail from lack of funds. The funds were there. Why did it fail? My thesis would be it failed because the people involved, the people in this country, didn't care enough to make it succeed. So if we have this type of behavior, what is the reason for it? Well, I would like to just express two views of human nature that I think are very common, but maybe in some sense of the word, we really don't think about them very often. The first is what would be the classical Greek concept of humankind and of human nature. And I think you would get through the writings of Socrates, and not the writings of Socrates, but through the writings of some of those Greek philosophers, Plato particularly, that there is the potential in humankind to develop complete rational thought and premise that will lead to eventually the perfect society. That if we only put all of our energies together and work in a very consistent rational pattern, we can solve most of the world's ills. And that philosophy has come down through the centuries and is probably now called in our society usually referred to as secular humanism. A second major threat in our society, in this country, has been the Judeo-Christian understanding of human nature. And although I think they would agree, the philosophers and theologians in the Judeo-Christian view would agree that humankind's ability to be rational and so on is very high, that the unfortunate fact, I would call it original sin, it could be described in different ways by different denominations and different religions, but I think the Judeo-Christian understanding that because of our fallen shadow self, our lack of ability, when it really comes right down to it, to allow our self-interest to be subjugated to the interests of the whole, is the basic reason why the Falkland Islands will continue to occur and did occur and will continue to occur, and why we haven't really solved these problems of famine and health and employment, etc., that occur not only in the world as a whole, but in this society here in the United States. Now, we have some good examples, and I'd like to compliment basically my hosts, I think, in the sense that the Mormon Church, I think, is an excellent example of a church that does and has attempted very strongly to take care of those people in the church who cannot take care of themselves. And certainly in the early days in this country, and Dr. Bella talked about the early days in this country, the church, primarily the Protestant denominations in this country, founded almost every major hospital, every major educational institution. Every college basically in the East Coast used to be a Presbyterian college. No longer, but it used to be. And so there have been examples where various organizations, primarily religious organizations, have been very active in dealing with these issues. At present time, it has primarily been the government that has taken over the responsibility for these issues. And I would have to say that, from my view, the government has been less than successful, and I include our own government. There are other examples, I think, of where I would put, why I would put the Judeo-Christian view of mankind, of humankind, as more relevant than the classical Greek concept. Examples of nationalism, and the Falkland Islands, again, is probably the best example of nationalistic behavior that absolutely makes no sense. We have unusual views of patriotism that exist in Northern Ireland, that exist in other countries, and also, I'm afraid, exist in our country. We have unusual sports fanaticism as a type of outgrowth of our kind of society. I told a couple of people at the table I was eating dinner with how I was asked to pray one time before a pro football game, and then maybe you've read about how most of the professional, particularly football teams, have gotten pretty much into the born-again Christian, or parts of the numbers of the members are involved in that activity. And so they usually like to ask some fairly well-known preacher personage to come ahead and to have a little service with the football team. Well, I was asked to do this for a team that will remain nameless. I don't want to be beaten up the next time I hit that city. They're much bigger than I am. And probably about 25 of the football team was there. And I gave a nice little inspirational talk because I was told that's what they wanted to hear. And then I prayed. And I prayed for them to go out and have a good game and do well and you know, be good Christians and so on and so forth. Never once did I say they should win. Well, after I finished the prayer, about five of these monsters literally attacked me and said, I didn't do it right. And I said, what do you mean I didn't do it right? They said, you didn't pray for us to win. And I said, well, I don't really think God cares whether you win or not. I have a feeling that God is really not too interested in the final score. I think he's more interested in how you're going to play the game, and I hope you play it well, and I hope the other team plays it well, and I know there's another man over there praying with that other team, and I don't want to set up a conflict here for God to have to make a major decision. But the point of that, needless to say, by the way, I was never invited back to lead a prayer session for that team. But the kind of fanaticism that goes with that concept, that somehow God is on our side, and if God's on our side, we'll beat the team we're playing in sports, and certainly in Northern Ireland, with the Protestant and Catholic both claiming that it's God that is directing their activities against their fellow Christian. So I would like to make a supposition tonight that one of our difficulties in our society is the problem of human nature. And the problem is that we are not perfect. And the problem is that with all of our rational thought, with all of our fine universities, with all of our ability to solve all sorts of wonderful problems, we have also found ways to destroy humankind. And Dr. Bella mentioned last night how that was certainly a clear possibility, and I think it is. We have learned from all of this rational thought all sorts of ways to cheat our neighbor in business, to bring down our governments, to involve ourselves in all types of scandal, and so forth and so on. And I would say that is part of the human condition. Now, I don't want to be pessimistic, and I'll try to be somewhat optimistic at the end anyway. But now I'd like to, after making the supposition that I would feel is the premise of the talk, that we have the classical Greek kind of thought that many of us would like to think can happen, that there is perfection at the end somehow, and then what I would see as a Judeo-Christian view, that unfortunately humankind has fallen and will remain so. Perfection will never occur. Then let us look at our business and public life, since I know you're probably more interested in me getting into some of the interesting aspects of my background. In our history, and now talking mainly about our society, we tend to have two types of scandals in business and government primarily. And I think the two have been exhibited in the last 10 years in Watergate and in Abscam. Abscam is probably a little more typical of the type of scandal that we'll have in business and in government and in the church, by the way, I think. Not a church specifically, but I think these activities are not relegated only to the business and political communities. Abscam is, I think, more typical. It is really primarily a scandal involving greed. There were no high and mighty motives that I think any of the congressmen and senators ever attempted to make about what they were doing there, other than trying to line their own pockets. And unfortunately, Richard Nixon and myself and all were caught on audio tape. They were caught on videotape, and it's a terrible, terrible problem. I certainly was glad to know that the one thing they didn't do was had videotape established in 1972 to the extent it was in 1980. And I think Abscam is really very common. It occurs at city governments, it occurs at county governments, it occurs at state governments, it obviously occurs in the national government. It has occurred forever. greed is part of our nature. And unfortunately, when there is opportunity to line one's own pockets without someone else knowing about it, it is very common. Bribery is common in numerous of our major business activities in our society. It is a fact of life in some businesses. You don't operate without bribery. Watergate is somewhat different, maybe more dangerous in a sense, but Watergate, to me, was a scandal involving not greed, because there really was almost no incidence of that in that scandal, but power. Watergate was a scandal that really involved control and the desire to perpetuate control and the desire to be in a powerful position and retain that position. I think my favorite theologian, probably because of my background, has been Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a Presbyterian minister and then taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York for years, and probably today would be considered, I think, the leading Christian ethicist of this century. And Niebuhr looked at two types of people in a book, Children of Light, Children of Darkness, which he published in the early 30s. And he would have defined children of darkness, that type of person, the child of darkness, would be the person you and I would call a sociopath today in the cities of New York and Chicago, and I'm sure here in Salt Lake, San Francisco, and so on. There are certainly in every community. These people have absolutely no concept of right and wrong. Unfortunately, you hear it more in New York and the larger cities where somebody just literally comes up to someone else and stabs them, doesn't even know who they are, or robs somebody for a dollar and kills five people in the process, or does some other act of that kind. Rape is clearly a sociopathic kind of violent crime. These people have no concept of right and wrong. When you ask me about prison reform, which any ex-prisoner is very involved in and interested in, unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion that these people, the sociopaths, and I remember reading Mailer's book about Gary Gilmore, and clearly Gilmore was a sociopath. And unfortunately, for those people, I'm afraid the only answer is to put them away for life in prison. Niebuhr would call these people the children of darkness. Now, we have unfortunately had some major figures in our society. The best known probably of our century was Adolf Hitler. I think Hitler clearly was a sociopath. I don't think there's any issue as to where he was psychologically. And he had no understanding of good and evil and right and wrong. But Niebuhr, interestingly enough, because Niebuhr was writing really against the rise of Hitlerism in Nazi Germany, having been German by background, he was writing during this period, so he was very aware of Hitler's nature. But in Children of Light, Children of Darkness, Niebuhr claims that he is really more concerned and more worried about the children of light. Now, who are the children of light? The children of light, ladies and gentlemen, you and I. Well, I include myself, but I would also include you. The children of light are people who basically want to do good. They are good people. They understand the difference between right and wrong. They understand the basic need for an ethical structure. They understand the need for fellowship and humanity among their fellow humankind. These are good people. But Niebuhr's thesis was that unfortunately these people many times do many evil things. And I would just use one example. I like to keep it in context out of this country so I can't get labeled by the press. But the German Christian Church is an example of the children of light. During the rise of Hitler, and including and through his reign till 1944, except for a few dissenters, the German Christian Church basically bought into Hitler's philosophy, accepted it, and literally preached from the pulpit about why his philosophy was acceptable. And they usually love to use Romans 8, which talks about obeying the civil authority. They like to forget Paul's other writings about when it is you might not obey the civil authority. But the vast majority of the German Christian Church, knowing full well what was going on in Nazi Germany at that time, bought into that. Whether it was active or passive really doesn't matter, because passive acceptance of evil is just as bad as active acceptance. So I don't think we can get off the hook by saying, well, I wasn't directly involved. I knew it was going on, but what could I do? I don't think we can get off the hook that easily. So Niebuhr's thesis basically is, I'm more worried about the children of light. Because unfortunately, like you and I, we think we are trying to do good. And then there's a second kind of characteristic about human nature that I think we ought to consider, and that's sort of our interest in what Waldo Beach, another Christian ethicist, talks about. He talks about the flashy sins. And Waldo's a very interesting guy. Just to laugh about some of the stuff, you ought to read some of it, because it's very kind of, his terminology is very good. And he says, we just love flashy sins. We write about them, we talk about them, because they're fun, and usually they don't involve us directly. Or at least we make sure that nobody knows they involve us. And the flashy sins are gambling, and prostitution, and adultery, and all those nice sins that sort of make good headlines. And having lived in New Jersey recently, and Atlantic City having just begun and prospered, and we're getting all of the crime and prostitution and so on that Las Vegas here has had for years, there's always news articles about what's going on in Atlantic City. Everybody likes to read about all of this evil that is down in Atlantic City. And I can honestly say that I do think gambling is evil, because I don't like doing it. And for some reason, I've never gotten hooked on it, so I can literally go into a casino if I'm in a town where there is one, and it doesn't even affect me at all. And I'd be a great preacher against gambling, because I have no interest in it at all. And I think most of us like to talk about those kind of flashy sins that we don't really have to worry about. And that's Beach's primary thesis. We love flashy sins, and we always talk about the ones that don't affect us. If we've got a happy marriage and somebody else is getting divorced, we talk about their divorce. If our divorce comes along, then we're very quiet about divorce. We go off to gambling, or we go to prostitution or homosexuality or some other type of thing that we would consider aberrational. And Niebuhr, going back now to Niebuhr and Beach, because Beach deals with this, both say, and I would feel strongly in agreeing with them, that those are sins, and yes, they are things that we should deal with as Christians, as people believing in a faith. But I think the real sins that we have to deal with are the ones that deal with power, pride, and self-interest. And these become much more complicated and much more difficult for any of us to deal with. And most of us really don't like dealing with them, because they involve all of us. Just a second, I've got a page turned around here. Where did page 4 go? Whoops. Here it is. In the folder. Niebuhr's next contribution, which I think is relevant to what I'm discussing tonight, really is contained in a book called Moral Man and Immoral Society. And don't be impatient, by the way. I'm going to get to more Watergate, so we'll get some Watergate in here. In Moral Man and Immoral Society, Niebuhr's main thesis is that the group is much greater than the sum of its parts. And I think if we all just think a minute on just minor issues. You think about something yourself and you believe something, but you're not really positive yet. You've just started to think about it. It's an interesting idea. And you go to some meeting, and most of the people and most of the vocal people and the ones who are really good about explaining something are against that position. How many times have we thought, well, maybe our original thoughts aren't too good. Maybe they're right. That sounds better than what I was thinking just on my own. And if these people think that, and I respect these people, then probably they may be right, and so I sort of go home and I forget my original thesis and say, well, if all my friends here in that group think that this is correct, then certainly what I was thinking about really must not have been right, and I'll not get into that anymore. And that occurs, I think, in all groups. I think all groups, as soon as we get to be more than 3, 4, 5 people, and I would include the church universal and the individual church, certainly our business associations, our political parties, and so on. As the group gets larger, the pressure, of the group on the individual becomes much more intense. And I think as the group begins to exercise its influence, those people who may have different views begin to go along because it's important for our egos, it's important for our jobs, it's important for our success in the secular world for us to maybe go along with what that group is thinking, even though we intuitively know this may not be the right thing, whether it's right ethically, whether it's right rationally, or whatever. And certainly, to me, a great example is the automotive industry today in our country. This is not really an ethical decision, although you might, I think you could put it in context with ethics, because we have put a tremendous number of our people out of work because of it. But back in 1972 and 1973, there was no question in the minds of the automobile executives, and I had direct dealings in this area, that they were fully aware of what was occurring in Japan and what would occur in this country probably if they did not start retooling and start dealing with the issues of better cars and better manufacturing processes. But their interest at that time was short-term profits, and they were willing, literally willing, to allow our entire auto industry to come to the verge of bankruptcy for what were strictly short-term profits in the early 70s. They were fully aware of what was going to occur. They had enough information, and these are very bright people, but their self-interest at that time was to perpetuate their own role in the corporations. And they perpetuated at the cost of us losing our predominant position in the auto industry. So I think this occurs in all of our society, and it occurs at the church and business community. And it isn't always, quote, as easily defined in an ethical situation, but I would, as I said, I think suggest that the auto situation, in a sense, has become very ethical because of the unemployment and the harm it has done to so many Americans. But now let us return to why you're really here, to Watergate. And I think it's clear to me when I thought back on Watergate, I don't think anyone came to Washington in the Nixon administration, who later became involved in Watergate, and there were 35 people convicted in that case, and many more involved. Anyone came to Washington to commit a crime. Almost all of the people were reasonably well educated. They were good people. John Ehrlichman and Bob Haldeman used to like to tell us as Christian Scientists how they didn't drink, smoke, or chase women. And they didn't. They had a very good basic moral structure. And I think for, quote, good people, in the terms Niebuhr would discuss children of light. In my own case, I came to Washington having been involved in political campaigns, having been a political science major and feeling that I could help society by being in Washington and working for the government. I had been taught, particularly at my college, at Williams College, was a very strong liberal arts school and had a very strong political science department, that it was a responsibility to be involved in government. So I don't think anyone came with that intention of perpetuating the crime. But as we were involved and as the war continued and other issues surfaced, there was a tendency for the group to feel threatened. It's been discussed in the press many times as to the psychological makeup of various and sundry members of the administration. Not being a psychologist, I'm not going to go into it. But there was a certain feeling of paranoia that did develop. I saw it. I don't think I really agreed with it, but I could see the basis for some of it. And the group felt threatened. Their existence felt threatened. At the time, and this is early, long before Watergate occurred, it did not seem that we would win re-election. At that time, in the early discussions that occurred about Watergate, Muskie was the front runner. People forget that, because by the time Watergate occurred, McGovern was the nominee, and I think the election was clearly, by that time, basically determined. But in the early stages, it wasn't. The trip to China had not occurred. Trip to Russia had not occurred. Some of the good things that came later had not happened, and we were not doing well in the polls. And it looked like if Muskie was nominated, he would win. So the group felt threatened. There was, I think, on the part of some of the members in the White House, a desire, a crusade almost, to wreak revenge. And revenge is a very sort of natural emotion. Somebody's doing some bad things to you, as far as you're concerned. So why not do some bad things back? And again, although most of the group did not feel that way, there was enough strength in those who felt that there was a need for revenge for the remaining part of the group to basically go along with this desire to, in a sense, get those people who are trying to get us. Now then comes forward G. Gordon Liddy, and you always need somebody like Liddy, I think, in this kind of event. And where all the rest of us are just thinking about things, Liddy's ready to do something. So G. Gordon comes into the Attorney General's office with a huge number of charts and interesting ideas of how we can wreak revenge on our rivals. Now, anybody who's been a manager here in an organization knows that one of the great ways to get something is to ask for much more than you want. Because, again, in a group kind of situation, when somebody comes in and asks for 500%, it's pretty hard to have him leave with nothing. So you sort of give him maybe 10% of what he's asked for, and he'll be happy, and things will be nice, and the group will now stay cohesive and continue to operate effectively. I'll ruin this radio station. 95-98% of Liddy's plans were absolutely dismissed out of hand. I mean, everyone said that, everyone, the three people at the meeting, the three will remain nameless. I was one of them. We all said, absolutely not, this is ridiculous. But he did hit a chord with one plan, and the one plan was to basically wiretap the Watergate office building, the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. And there are lots of reasons why he hit a chord of responsiveness on that specific plan. And that was all Liddy really got. But from this huge, gigantic scheme of charts and so on, there was this one little line item, and he got that one little line item. And I think if we think about it in groups, many times we will sort of say, yeah, well, well, that's not important. And that was really part of it. It didn't seem important. We had been so sort of at the point of exhaustion from working on, I think, important things. We were doing things that we thought really counted, that this kind of thing over here, which was at that time something to me that was very unnecessary and unethical, as well as being criminal, was allowed to slip through. And I think in a sense that's really what happened. It slipped through because there was enough desire for it within certain members of the group. And we were too busy. So we, in a sense, said, okay, let it go through. I'm not, by the way, defending that decision. It was clearly a wrong decision. It was unethical and it was criminal. And then we compounded it by doing what, again, I think is a necessary ingredient in many times in a good way of human nature, but in this case in a bad way. Now, when Watergate broke, there was survival. It wasn't no longer just getting reelected. It was now survival. And so the cover-up, I think, occurred because everybody's not only job was threatened, but the whole their family structure, the prospect of going to prison, the prospect of financial loss. And I think we have to be very careful in any function we're in to realize how important those things are to all of us. And if you are threatened with the loss of your job, with the loss of your income and so on, what you might do to prevent that. And in our case, we decided it was best, and we had all kinds of nice motives, high motives, to cover up this minor, as Ron Ziegler used to call it, second-rate burglary. And it was a second-rate burglary. Not done very well. And so we covered it up and compounded our initial lack of understanding of what we were really there in Washington for. And, of course, by covering it up, we, in eventual terms, led to the dissolution of the presidency. Now, that is a compilation maybe of how and why Watergate occurred, at least from my view. It was the old argument of the end justifying the means. But I'd like to give just one more example that maybe more to where you might be able to relate. I think sometimes it is hard to relate to being in the White House and to doing the kind of things that were going on in the White House. It's hard for me today to relate to what's really going on with George Shultz and Cap Weinberger and so on and so forth in the government, and I was there. But I still have a hard time now really knowing what's really going on. And I think we sometimes put it at a distance. But I think these type of things occur in many ways. I've talked about the auto industry, but after Watergate, I went back to a corporate position for a while to see whether my journey in a faith sense was something I wanted to continue. And I remember this incident, and it's a good incident for me to tell because I come out well in this case, so I'll tell this incident. But I was dealing on a project, and we were dealing with a pricing structure for a new product. And someone from the corporate headquarters came in to determine how we were going to, whether we were going to get the capital expenditures for the machine we needed to produce this product, and whether we would then be able to produce it and make a profit. All of which is good business sense. Well, when this person came in, we had said, we think we can get a certain share of market if we price this product at this level, because there's already existing competition and they're up here at this level, and since this product is not differentiated by any particular means or attributes, we'll come in under the market and be able to pick up a percentage share of the market and do well. And he indicated he didn't agree with that type of pricing policy. He wanted us to come in up here with the competition that was already entrenched. And I said, well, of course, if you're a person over this situation, you can price the product anywhere you want. I said, I don't agree with that, but that's your prerogative. So he said, well, good. And to further that, Jeb, I'd like a memo from you telling me that you want to price this product at this higher level. I said, ooh, wait a minute. He is putting me in a nice box, because if we price the product up here and it doesn't go, he's got that memo from me saying I'm the one recommending this price and I don't even agree with it. I said, I'm sorry, I can't send you that memo. And the other person with me in the meeting said, well, of course you can. I mean, we have to. We need the product. We need that machine. We need the money. And I said, well, you can send the memo, but I'm not going to send the memo because I don't believe in that pricing structure. I will price it for whatever you tell me to, but I can't tell you that I'm the one who believes in it. Well, I knew my days would be numbered in that situation. And whether I would have made that stand 10 years ago, I don't know. And I'm not sure why I made the stand then, other than I knew that this was wrong. And at that time, I was not going to get involved in another situation that had some similarity to Watergate. And it did have some similarities. And I think the point I would like to make about this is that these things do occur in all of our existence. And I don't think they are only relegated to the political structure. I think they are not relegated to that structure. They're relegated to all of our structures. And that we as people of faith have to understand our human nature and deal with it. And understand that we may not always make the right decision. And I think the real question then is, how do you, if you have made the wrong decision on an ethical basis, how do you then go on and live your life? I would conclude that we have to understand the shadow side of our existence, of our human nature. This has occurred throughout human history. There is no period in our history, recorded history, where these type of events have not occurred. And we can just go through, whether it's Alexander the Great or David, the great king of Israel, who probably committed more sins than all of us combined, in a sense, and was a murderer. Yet he was a man of God. These negative events have occurred in all of human history. And they are not just happenstance. As Paul says, we look through a glass darkly. And I think these events are not happenstance. They are part of our nature. And my answer, my positive answer, because I think there is some positive here, is I think we have to rely on the love ethic as expressed best, I think, by Christ as well as by the Apostle Paul, and posture our relationships, whether they're in the church, whether they're in business or government, in regards to the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of man. As Reinhold Niebuhr stated, we must always strive. And I think that's the key word, strive and struggle to perfect our society, knowing that we will never reach that level of perfection. Striving for this, as he called it, impossible possibility, I think is what is striving for God's kingdom here on this earth. Thank you very much. Thank you. Peggy asked me if I would answer any questions. I will, with the understanding I'm not really interested, nor will I get into discussions of personalities involving, particularly in the Watergate case. But I would certainly answer most questions, I think, if any case. I'm sorry, can you say that just a little louder? Yeah. I just couldn't hear that last part. I think if I look back on it, I knew what we were doing was wrong from the beginning. I think I was aware of it then, at that time. I just kept it down at the bottom level of consciousness, which I think we do very easily. I knew it was wrong, but it wasn't important, and I was doing all sorts of important things, and since I was now an important person and this wasn't important, what difference did it make? We have great abilities to rationalize, and I think I basically, even at the beginning, knew it was wrong, but said, well, I can't do anything about it, and since it's so minor, etc., I'll just let it be. It'll go away. I really think that I did know at the beginning, but I suppressed it. Now it became clearer and clearer as my feet got more hot water that it was wrong. Well, I think that's a very good statement, by the way, of what I would look to see in a religious organization that is active and vibrant. That the fellowship between the members is such that it prevents much of what I talked about today. And I would certainly hope in my ministry in Burlingame that I'm going to be able to deal with whole groups of people and convey love and fellowship with them to help them as I was helped later through many people within my faith. And I can name Mark Hatfield and Louis Evans, who was my pastor, who supported me in this journey for years. I mean, it started in 1972. And I would hope that is one of the functions the church universal, and all of our individual churches perform. Unfortunately, in this case, it was not strong enough for many of these people to overcome the other factors is really the point I would make here. And so I would look to Niebuhr to strive for that impossible possibility to do just what you're talking about, to build some foundations for people to depend on. And I think, by the way, the church is the only answer. I don't see any answer outside of a faith experience, a belief in God and so on. So I would agree very much with what you would hope would occur in situations of this kind. It did not occur in this situation, it didn't occur in APSCAM, and it didn't occur in the Falkland Islands. So what I would say to that is that, unfortunately, as much as we try to have it occur, and it does occur, in many cases, it doesn't occur enough to perfect the society as we would like to. Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think I could have stopped it occurring. Number one, I think I would have been kicked out of the group and lost my job. But I think I could have stopped it occurring. I think any number of the people could have stopped it occurring. I do think they would have then been basically dismissed from the group, which probably would, of course, been the best thing that ever happened to me. I would have loved to have been fired in retrospect, but I think I could have, yes. There were a couple of points where I said we should stop this, and then the group was convincing. A number of us said that at different times. But we were, I had four children and so on, and I had a good income, and I was doing well, and I liked to have the limousine pick me up in the morning, and it was kind of nice being there in Washington. Very seductive. And I just probably wasn't mature enough and willing enough to take that stand at that time. Life was too nice at that time. And I didn't think of the consequences of it in that sense. Well, I am not an expert in other religions, Islam or so on. My basis is in Judeo, Old and New Testament studies. so it's hard for me to really answer that. Obviously, other countries have different mores, as an example about bribery. In other countries, bribery is an accepted form of behavior, in Mexico and so on. Mexico is a Catholic country, but evidently that does not affect the way they do business. I don't really know why. And it'd be hard for me to give you a good answer. I'm not a church historian or expert in other faiths. But it's clear to me that what Niebuhr talks about is relevant not only to a Christian, it's relevant to anyone. I mean, the shadow side of all of us, in Niebuhr's terms, I think occurs with all of us, all humankind, not just Christians. How you deal with it with other people, I'm just not a professional in that area. Probably someone here could comment on that much better than I could. Is that, I'm sorry, did I sort of... Maybe there's some other experts here. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'd all like to be able, I mean, I'd love to convert everybody to Presbyterianism, and I'm sure all of you here are Mormons would like to convert everyone to Mormonism. I think that's all good activity myself that will lead to good things. Evangelical type activity, I think, is very important in our faith, in my faith, and I would assume it's important in your faith here for most of you. That's how we reach people for an understanding of the faith side of their life. So I'm, you know, very strongly in favor of evangelical type of activity by legitimate religious groups. Yes. I have some very strong ethical difficulties with both Woodward and Bernstein. I would not put them on any pedestal, and I've said it publicly. Their activities, they might say just at the end that they claim they reached, which, by the way, they had almost nothing to do with the breaking of the Watergate case. All of the movie and all of the book is basically exaggeration and misinformation. Not all of it. The key portions that would indicate their role was somewhat elaborated on in the book and then even more so in the movie. So Deep Throat is a character who may or may not exist. I don't know. They've used it very effectively as a public relations tool to sell more books and to do better in their careers. Brilliant stroke of public relations genius. I really don't think he exists personally. As one person. And the information he gave them, according to them, was almost negligible in importance. Are you kidding? In our denomination and in most of the Protestant denominations, ministerial burnout is a problem that does occur to people. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to let other people run for office, and I'll worry about ministerial burnout 10 years from now. No, I think that I think I will leave that to other people to contribute in that area. My son just finished college, worked for Senator Bradley in New Jersey, may go back to work there or in another type of situation with someone like Senator Bradley, and I think that's great, but I'd rather have my son do it than have me do it again. I think I can have more effect on in a limited role in a society as a minister. Once is enough. No, I don't. I think that was a secondary issue. I think the main issue I tried to make was it was the group pressure that was the most important issue. I think any group, whether they're in the White House or in City Hall or in business, can have the same effect for other reasons. It doesn't have to be the limo and the White House. It can be getting your next salary increase in your position and not fighting your boss over an issue, because if you do, you might not get that salary or maybe get terminated. It could be in a family situation, negating your own feelings about how, say, your children should be brought up so you avoid conflict in the family. See, my point is, it doesn't occur just in Washington because it was nice and powerful, and it was nice and we had all these perks. That had something to do with it, certainly. But it occurs today, here and now, in all communities, in all societies, for all different reasons. And the group has a tremendous effect, whether that group is a family or a group in a volunteer organization. How often does a group that starts out with some great purpose get sidetracked off by very strong personalities who decide that they want that group to become the reason for their existence, and the group becomes the pawn for them to accomplish their goals? And I don't want to get in a controversy, but I could think of some that have occurred in the past couple of years that have shown that the self-interest of the group leaders was much more important than the functioning of the group that initially set out for good purposes. So I don't want to imply that nice atmosphere was the reason. It had something to do with it, yes. It made it a little more difficult, probably. Certainly if you were working in a job and you're single and you're not making very much money and you get in an argument with your boss, well, you're probably more flexible. But if you're married and you're making more money and you've got kids and you've got to educate them and clothe them, probably that decision gets more difficult then. And that's probably more a factor than maturity or any other reason. I think many mature people are more involved. Look at Abscam. Every one of those people were mature, professional politicians. Almost every one of them. A couple were second-term Congress. Most of them had been there. Senator Harrison Williams was one of the most best thought of people in the Senate. A number of the congressmen, the one from Trent, New Jersey, was a dean of the Congress. Or not dean, but certainly one of the leaders in the Congress. These were not immature people. Well, immature in age, certainly. They were not. Okay. Thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.
Just say one last thing, which is one last favor, and that is, we need feedback. We need praise, we need criticism, we need suggestions, we need assistance, we need volunteers. One lady said yesterday, "Let me help you with registration next year." I said, "We'd be glad to have you help us with registration." So really, feedback is important. Thank you very much.